If we had an electricity availability factor incentive scheme which said if you take the factor from 46% to 64%, you get a piece of the action, I promise you we would have got to 64% quickly. You know, you've got to always look behind the deal to what incentives it creates and what behavior it drives.
Mark, hello. This is unusual.
I tell you, man, for the first time, we're sitting here in front of real people. It's like pretty cool. Eh?
It's amazing.
If I'd known there were going to be so many people here, I would have put on a whole outfit thing, you know. Yeah. So, no, it's good. We're sitting here in Metis Strategy Advisors. It's our first time to have something of an interactive stand-up business. So this week could be on better behavior, but I wouldn't back that as an opportunity. What are we going to talk about, man? I tell you, this Bokke thing, eh? It's got legs. This Springbok, you know, sell it.
I wanted to ask you something about this because I'm sort of conflicted and you are very helpful in sorting out conflicts.
That's what I do, man. I'm a giver. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't cause trouble. You solve problems.
That's it.
That's what you're about. So here's my question. Is it usual in a private equity deal for you to get your money back? So you invest, say, in this case, $75 million. And then in the contract, it says that you get your money back and at 6% at the very minimum at the end of the 8-year contract. Is that completely unheard of? Is that sensible?
No, it's not unheard of. There's always someone on the top and someone on the bottom in these deals. I think the Springboks are under the scrum as far as this deal is concerned at the moment. They've been given one properly. Okay. And so that's the definition of a loan, not an investment. And so they're essentially making a loan into the box. And they've been given 20% of the upside and control of the board while they don't get their money back, which essentially means that if the box default, they've bought 100% of the company for that amount of money, you know, on the loan. So, and of course, ever shy Gayton McKenzie, who's terrified of sports coverage, you know, I mean, he doesn't really make himself visible at any occasions of that sort of nature. He's ringing the hat, okay, and he's saying, guys, you must do this. I'm not sure he's got any locus standi. I use those words because there's some lawyers in the room, right? Hey, you think I know nothing? Oh, yeah, yeah. So I think 7 of the unions voted against it. And so it's up in the air.
Well, no. The vote hasn't happened. The vote got delayed. They were.
Behind the news, don't look at me. But I think it happened. It's already been like a secret ballot thing.
Okay. But anyway, we know that it's now on ice and we are going to discuss it. And 3 months later, they're going to come back for it. So if you were trying to argue in favor of this, what would you say? How would you argue the upside for South Africa and the Springboks? Because it's easy to argue the negative, right? Nobody wants to sell. You shouldn't sell the Springboks. The Springboks are part of our life. We can't sell the Springboks. But presumably, they're not doing this because they want to. They have to, right? What would you say? How would you sell it if you were talking to Gayton McKenzie now? You wouldn't.
Oh, good, man. Okay. I can find no upside to talk about. Okay. Some people are going to, if you look at all the sport, it's being sponsored by the betting companies. We won't step away. We talked about this a bit last week. Next, they're going to sell the players, right? And then if you're on the field and you've got a little side bet on yourself, you might just not want to pass that ball or pass that ball sooner. I draw the line when it comes to national pride. I mean, for me, the Springboks are the manifestation of what we dream about when we talk about a rainbow nation. Okay. And the reason they succeed is because they've got common purpose and national pride. And if you take either one of those two things away and you entered into the good old-fashioned world of money, you're in a different movie completely. So I'm totally, totally against it. But that's probably
because I haven't been offered a commission. Every single one of the big clubs have got private investors now. I never heard you complaining about that. What's the difference?
I see the difference between club sport and national sport. Okay. And in the World Cup last year, the 15 or 23, now that Russia's in charge, there are 23 oaks in a team, not 15. Okay. So in that version of the sport, I think there were 20% of all World Rugby Cup players were South Africans by birth. And there were 16 teams, so you can do the math, or even if you can't. There were a lot of us, you know, that very famous Irishman, Bok van der Linde, and, we've got them in the cricket team as well. We've got Labuschagne, who used to be Labuschagne, who now plays for the Aussies. And, you know, I can't think of how low can you go for money. So I'm not really for it, but enough of that.
All right. One interesting thing that has come out of this that I didn't know beforehand was about the deal that was struck between the private equity company and the All Blacks. It was, you know, done in a much higher multiple than the one, the Springbok, that's bad enough as it is. But the interesting thing about it was it's now existed for 5 years, I think. And the private equity company itself is, you know, it doesn't like the deal anymore. I mean, partly because they overpaid, obviously, but also because I think it's just very hard to sell a national team. You know what I mean? What do you do? How do you boost a national team? So you say, okay, presumably when they went into the deal, they said, oh, there's All Black supporters all around the world. Think of the advertising we could spend on the, you know, but the problem is if you are in the UK, you know, you might have respect for the All Blacks, but it's not an advertising plus necessarily because you're going to support your national team. And, you know, it's possible there's some Americans who, you know, might support the All Blacks, but not many. So I just think there's a structural problem with trying to squeeze, you know, advertising revenue out of a national side.
It's not like their performance has gone up since someone put money in there. Okay, it's gone down. And they paid like a big multiple of what they're paying us. So, and I've never liked the All Blacks anyway. So, you know, I mean, so I saw somewhere the other day that there's been more money that's gone into private equity worldwide than has ever come out of it. And you look to the incentive. You know, the incentive is how much fund you've got under management, okay? And so there's no incentive for the private equity guys ever to give the money back. They've got to keep reinvesting it, okay? So you've got to think about that a bit, which brings me to another topic, which is the Road Accident Fund. I don't know if you've read about that thing. It's in the news at the moment, okay? And I also think it's got to do with incentive. They changed their accounting policy from an IFRS, you know what IFRS is? They changed from that, which says basically that when a claim arrives, you make provision for it, which I would have thought, yeah, just in case, you know. But they decided, nah, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're only going to provide for the claim when we've made an offer of settlement. Okay. What that did to their liabilities, and I think this was in 23, is it reduced them by 90% from like 300 million of recorded liabilities to 24 million of recorded liabilities. Turns out, their incentive scheme is related to the NAV of the company. Guess what? Okay. So now they've got this unrecognized potential liability of 500 billion, but it's not recorded. It's recorded at like 10% of that. And so be careful what motivates you. Money doesn't motivate the Oaks to play for the Springbok jersey, man. The guys that come from, you know, Graaf Reinet, you know, they want that wear that book jersey mainly to get a throw. It's always been my view that our public servants aren't all overpaid. The structure's wrong. You get paid the same no matter the outcome. And so why should you work harder? Why? I mean, if we had an electricity availability factor incentive scheme which said if you take the factor from 46% to 64%, you get a piece of the action, I promise you we would have got to 64% quickly. You know, you've got to always look behind the deal to what incentives it creates and what behavior it drives. And I think it's fundamentally wrong to do sport in that way, despite all the money that you can make.
Let's move on to something we know really a lot about, the American election.
Yeah. Talk about fishing in a shallow pond. But I mean, really? Someone asked me the other day, who would you vote for? And I said, I can only tell you two people that I wouldn't vote for. And that would be the candidates, right? Yeah, what's going to happen, Tim?
What's going to happen? You know, it's amazing. Yeah, exactly. Why do you think that that Americans like Trump so much when we obviously see a flawed candidate? I mean, both candidates might be flawed, but I mean, it's pretty obvious. Trump is the most flawed presidential candidate in history in America. What's happening here? Do you have a sense?
I mean, I think that it's the loud mouth that appeals to the loud mouths, and the loud mouths get the most listenership. I get, you know, something like that. I think he's a complete manic. You know, I think he's mad. Okay. But having said that, he appeals to the sort of disaffected and the non-wokes and the tough oaks there from the Midwest or wherever they come from. And he's expedient in whatever he's prepared to say. And he talks the most unadulterated horseshit I've ever heard come out of a presidential candidate. Okay. And it works. And it works here as well, by the way. It's a kind of a recipe, okay? So it's the more you promise, the more you get. It's hard for me to believe that a population of 350 million couldn't come up with a better selection of people because they borderline childish in their behavior.
I've got a different theory. So,
of course.
Yeah. You know, the whole idea of make America great again, isn't this a geopolitical thing? That America's, it's not on the decline, but relatively speaking, it's not the...
The World Series ain't going to be the World Series for long.
Yeah. So, and I think in a sort of like a funny way, Americans sense this. They sense a country which is not absolutely declining, but is relatively declining. And they want someone to just reassert themselves. You know, it's a very difficult thing for a country that is, you know, has been cock of the hoop for almost a century now to imagine that they might not be in that position. So, you know, that so it's a very... In a funny sort of gut kind of way, it's very appealing to have somebody say, we'll get back there. You know, just, and maybe that's what the Democrats don't really understand about Trump. They're not understanding
It's a cause worth talking about, because if you think of the new opposition, the new world, you know, if you add China together with India, together with Russia, together with whatever, the Eastern and Asian blocs, and you ask how they're doing, they're doing kind of well. Okay, in terms of relative outperformance. And they come from a world which I would argue has got a high degree of autocratic, you know, government. And having said that, if you look at what's happening in China, the state looks to help business, not to fight it. Now, they might help it in a very disciplined way, but the state pitches up and go, we like what you're doing, we're going to back you to do it, not... You know, we're going to disagree with you like we do here. The gap here between politics and business is vast. Okay, and so it's an extraordinary force. And maybe you end up, as Trump is doing and doing well, appealing to patriotism.
It is going to be an extraordinary time if Trump does win. All of the bookies say that they are...
Bookies are saying 54%, eh?
Yeah. And I do have one statistic which I thought was really just amazing. Do you know that in 2005, the British economy was the same size as the Chinese economy? 2005, it wasn't that long ago. Now,
wow.
Now China four times the size.
Yeah.
And that trend is, you know, it's China's only the first of several countries which are going to go through that leapfrog process.
What is that? Because that's a big issue. What is that? I've got some idea what happens when businesses become legacy businesses, you know, like IBM or Kodak, and they don't change with the changing technology. You know. But what happens with, you know, systems like capitalism and socialism, whatever these drivers are, ideologies, should I say? And how does a system become old-fashioned and irrelevant? And if you start looking at the value of the individual now, you know, and the access to the economics of the individual, then you start recognizing the value of data being, you know, a driver of so many forces. And maybe we've just got old people in charge. I mean, if you go back to, you know, sort of Obama, Kennedy, Clinton, these guys were between 45 and 50 years old. Hard to believe now. Okay. Now everyone's over 70. And we've got the same problem here. And we've got people in charge whose past is more relevant than their future. And if you haven't got a 50-year-old leader who's got more ahead of him or her than he's got behind him or her, then you've got a problem, because they don't plant their harvest.
I mean, it is so ironic as well, because the other thing I wanted to talk about was the American economy is just incredibly strong. I mean, the S&P is now just under its record. It just hit another record. You know, are you pro the sort of new wave of American companies? Are you a big investor in NVIDIA and all of that? I mean, would you recommend that?
Okay, embarrass me. Go on. Embarrass me. No, I haven't got a single NVIDIA share. Okay. You know, I didn't know. Yeah, well, if you start looking at the drivers, there are few of them. Right? There are fewer and fewer companies that are determining the index in terms of weighting.
Yeah.
You've got the same challenges. Yeah. I think there's a disconnect starting to happen between the real economy and the weight of funds. For example, I read today that the volume in retailers in South Africa is actually stagnating, but the turnover is going up, which means that the price is just changing. Okay, and so is that something you can link to a stock market discussion? You know, are the PE multiples, I don't know if there are people old enough in the room to remember what a PE multiple was, because it's kind of so irrelevant now, so old fashioned, so not us. Okay. And so you're not buying earnings, you're buying, you know, access to people. That's the new valuation metric. You know, what's the average revenue per client or per user or per whatever? Okay. And so it's an extracting economy, not a building economy. You know, Tim, I've actually lost it.
That's not unusual. But I'll save you with a statistic, you would like, because I just found this chart. It's very interesting. Instinctively, you're amazingly in line, at least with this. So what these people have done is they've taken the top seven stocks in 2000, in the 2000 tech bubble, right? And compared them with the top seven stocks now along a whole bunch of metrics. So the percentage of the US market cap of the Magnificent Seven now, 31%. The percentage of the Magnificent Seven in the 2000, just before the tech bubble, 19%, half, or a little bit more than half. But the Magnificent Seven, more money. They have a roundabout as a cash, as a percentage of their market cap is about 4%. The tech bubble, they had no money. They were 1.7% of their market cap. And the PEs, obviously at the time, because they, you know, the money wasn't there, the PEs were much higher in 2000 than they are now. They were 52, and they are now 23, which is not very big. And
you know, I've never sat in a quiet room talking about how I would value a company amongst people who are trying to value it with me and come up with 23 as a reasonable PE multiple. Okay. I'm still in the six, you know. It's not about PEs anymore. They're irrelevant. It's not about NAV anymore. It's irrelevant. It's about anticipated growth and the present value of the margin that you can extract from the next individual at the margin. And you present value that. And in fact, equity is no longer defined, in my view, as the amount of capital you put into a business, but the amount of capital you are able to extract from a business going forward in the margin. So as you grow and grow and grow and your, you know, economies of scale and stuff, and you don't decrease the margin, you have essentially equity creation in turnover. If you actually believe that, you'll believe anything, okay? But I think it's true.
Anyway, good. All right, we're going to take questions now if anybody has any.
You know, there was a kind of a common theme going through a number of the things that you spoke about, the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. From what I can understand, and friends who've got sort of family in America, you can't put Democrats and Republicans in the same room now. They're like football supporters. If they're on different sides, they'll fight with each other. And so there's this huge divide in the community. And you're talking about what drives a clown like Trump to be popular. And you're also talking about the movement from service and virtual assets to manufacturing assets. And a lot of the common thread through there is social media. My personal view is that social media is probably one of the biggest evils of our time. And I think a lot of the division that's happening in the world is that social media becomes an echo chamber where people take their views and amplify it. And then you've got clowns like Trump who milk that. Am I kind of alone in my thoughts, or does that kind of ring any bells?
Not at all. I mean, it's actually social media is a divider between the two of us, because I don't advertise our podcast on social media, and Mark does.
I'm single.
And I occasionally get a whipping I'm just astounded by what social media has done. It's just elevated so the most crazy voices. But, you know, it's not going away. It's going to get worse. I think we just got to get used to it and past it. So concentrate more on what we want to know and listen to.
I think in South Africa, the reason why we're still doing okay, if not going to do quite well, is because of the informal economy. The unvalued economy is what's keeping South Africa going. It's huge. Okay. And if you look at the companies that have made success out of that in the last 20 odd years, and it is that long, it's the Capitec and the ShopRites and the people who have focused on the broad-based economy and the informal economy. And you know, there's some retailers you'd argue are focusing on a 5% client base. It's insane. Whereas others are focusing on a 90% of the population client base. And so you've got these very divided economies, I think, in South Africa, and very polarized views. And the thing to try and figure out is that both parties really think they're right on opposite sides of this void of intersection, which is what we all need to get to if we've got half a chance of pulling this off. And so, yeah, there's the old and the new. There's everything is pretty polarized. And
One of the problems is that the old people are still here, and we think we're right, and we're not right. We don't even know. And if you look at what's going to happen to demographics in the next, by 2050, there will be 30% plus of the population that are over 65 years old. Currently, that's about 15 to 20%. And so all of these kind of dynamics should guide all sorts of things, including elections and where you invest capital. And so, yeah, the world is changing, but the leaders are aging. That's, for me, an amazingly difficult thing to contemplate. You know, if you look at all of them, you know, as they say, once you're in, stay in. But they're staying in for a long time. And the successful South African companies have purposely extracted their aging leadership in favor of the youth and stayed in the room. And overseen them and guided them in a, sort of a captain cockpit, young pilot kind of model.
Okay, just to a saying extracted from George Orwell, coal good, renewables bad. Your comment.
So one of the weird things about this podcast is that I do it from this tiny little town in the middle of Karoo. When we went to go and live there, we were so far from the road that we thought I had to get electricity from the road to where we are, which is like quite deep in the mountains, and it was very expensive because Eskom doesn't pay for that. And you have to have poles of a certain size. They have to be in the ground. And, you know, there's some rules and regulations about putting electricity in. So we decided we were going to use solar power long before it was fashionable. And honestly, it was the most fabulous, wonderful thing. It was just incredible. You get to crossroads and you take the wrong turning so many times. But the times that you take the right turning, you've just got to cherish them. And I haven't paid Eskom a bill in 15 years. And that just makes me so happy.
I mean, the other fact, I would revise the question a little bit by saying this. What do you do if you've got an abundance of coal in a renewable world? Because that's really so we've got tons. I mean, the last coal-fired power station in Britain was closed last month, the last ever. So they've got none. Okay. And they're going into all sorts of things. I can remember when we were first questioned on an international stage about Kuberg, you know. And I think it was, what was his name? The Oak with the Buck, one of the Boertes. And they were saying, and what about this nuclear power station? He said, no, we haven't got one. And the guy went on and on. He said, you know, the one Kuberg. Oh, that nuclear power station. You know, I think our trouble is we've got an abundance of coal and it comes out of the ground. So the economics of using it up is quite compelling, but it's not the answer. It's not the future. And it was one of the challenges that Eskom has, is if they'd been amazingly successful, they would have ended up with a very efficient dinosaur.
All right. Well, that's more or less our time. Thanks very much, everyone. It's been a pleasure. Here we're sitting in a hall of about 50 people. And,
looking at us
while we talk. And we're not looking at each other.
And it's so good odd. Faces for radio.
Yeah, yes. Someone did mention there's a big picture of us behind us here on the screen. And someone mentioned that we need to take photographs which are a little bit more up to date.
Yeah. Speak for yourself, man.
Yeah.